all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm really pleased to be doing the show today, in spite of all the rain. In fact, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning because there were like rain. It sounded like gigantic snow boulders falling on my house, and it was just giant drops of rain, okay? And even the dogs who just charge out of the door in the morning would not go outside because they didn't want to get wet. Think of that, Rottweilers that don't want to get wet, okay? And they're too scared to go out, so they sit there whimpering. Anyway, I digress. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking to Anna Lily Amirpour, an Iranian-American film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor, and she's most known for her feature film debut, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, a self-described Iranian vampire spaghetti western that made its debut at the Sundance Film Festival in 2014. So stick around for that. That's going to be an exciting interview, all right? Well, right now, I'm pleased to bring on to the show Lundy Brown. And as I said, Lundy she's a professor at Brown University. She's the author of a book that has just driven me crazy reading it and trying to, you know, really wrap my head around what's going on. The book is Breathing Race into the Machine, and it's the surprising career of the spirometer from plantation to genetics. And in this book, Lundy, a professor of Africana Studies at Brown University, reveals the political and social influences that constantly shape science and technology. She traces the history of the spirometer and explains its role in establishing a hierarchy of human health and the belief that race is a kind of genetic essence. This is not only part of the history of the U.S., but it's something that continues to reassert itself today. And quite frankly, you know, you can see it from a couple decades ago when ex-LA police chief Daryl Gates made the comment that, well, black people have a different physical anatomy, so they don't really suffer when you put them in a chokehold, to the kind of things that allow the murder of a 12-year-old boy in a park in Cleveland, that allow a young man to be killed for walking into a dark stairwell trying to get down the stairs, that allow a man to be choked to death on camera and nobody gets indicted, that allow a young man 18 years old to have his hands up and be shot dead, savagely shot, and nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens. And it's to no small extent, the idea that black people are something less than human plays a big role in this, and it's a very dangerous, dangerous trip to make. And that's, I think, what I felt was concentrated in Lundy Brown's book. Lundy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Good, good. Well, let's jump into this. Breathing Race into the Machine. Give us a synopsis of the story and why you felt compelled to write this. Because I got to tell you, when I saw it about the spirometer, I said, who the hell's going to write about a spirometer?
I think everybody has that initial feeling. And actually, you know, in the introduction, I do mention that this is an instrument that probably many, many people have encountered when they go to the physician and have respiratory measured. But they never know the name of the instrument. So writing a story of the spirometer actually was a challenge when I talked to people. I came to write this book actually somewhat serendipitously. So I was teaching pathology to med students when I first got the idea. And I was also in a workshop organized by Evelyn Hammonds, first at MIT and then at Harvard. But it was a group of people in the northern New England or New England area that were discussing the topic of race in medicine. And simultaneously, I happened to read in the newspaper back in those good old days when you actually read newspapers at the kitchen table in the morning. And I saw this article about an asbestos case in Baltimore in which attorneys for Owens Corning, the defendant in this large, large asbestos lawsuit, argued that race correction should be applied to pulmonary measurements in order to determine who could go on the active docket, that is, who could become eligible for compensation. And I was really struck by this idea, and actually the newspaper article in the Providence Journal said, you know, it's well established that blacks and white have different lung capacity. So I just, at that moment, you know, it was a convergence of different being in a particular places, actually. And I just started researching it. And a good friend, David Kern, who was a pulmonologist, said, yes, that's the consensus. He gave me a bunch of articles. And with that, I just started researching the history, where that idea could possibly have come from. And obviously what was particularly striking is that the idea of race textural difference was so deeply embedded that there was a correction factor in the spirometer. And so that opened up ways of thinking about how racialized ideas become normative, and we don't even know that we're actually acting out deeply racist assumptions.
Now, this is not, as I understand it, this is not something that's just sort of like came up in that one court case that you have, but this is actually standard practice in pulmonary medicine, right?
It's not only standard practice, but it's in correction factors, either population, I mean, there's two different kinds of correction factors, but that's actually part of the machine. So,
can you explain what a correction factor is?
It refers to two different ways of basically establishing different norms for the lungs of blacks as compared to the lungs of whites. Now, other groups are increasingly included in this, but historically in the U.S., this has been about black and white difference. And this is based on studies. Essentially, a correction factor is reducing the normal in blacks by about 15% of that of whites. So whites are the standard of normal. Black normal is set at 15% below that. And again, I want to emphasize that's based on studies. That's one way. And the other is to develop different standards for different populations. Study Mexican Americans, study whites, study African Americans, and then use those standards. The problem with this is, you know, in fact, we know that pollution affects lungs profoundly and that minorities live in highly polluted areas. So it's actually not surprising that certain groups would have lower lung function than others. What is the problem here is that the explanations of difference have a strong current. I won't say every single person holds this idea, but have a strong current that there are innate differences. That is, that blacks, whites, and actually almost any group you look at throughout the world are genetically different in their lung capacity. The explanations, what I was really concerned about is we know there's higher mortality among minority groups in this country, for example, and that's typically called racial disparities in disease. We know that. It's a fact. What matters is how you explain that fact. Mm-hmm. Is it the social experience of racism along with, you know, many other factors living in polluted environments, or is it genetic? Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm concerned with.
Yeah, exactly. And very, very, very rightfully so. You present a very strong case around this, you know, what you're talking about, and you call it the racialization of the spirometric measurements. And, you know, you argue that the problem is not the spirometer itself, but what's been done in connection with its use. That there's,
right.
You know, so there is a value to the spirometer in medical practice, but the problem is it's been racialized. Let's talk about that. What do you mean it's been racialized, and what's the impact of that?
Okay, so that's a great question. Oftentimes when we talk about racialization, we mean that some sort of essentialized notion of race has gotten attached to medicine, or in this case, the instrument. And so, again, it's the idea, it's the explanatory framework, I mean, to use sort of a technical term, but what kinds of explanations do we actually assign to this? Now, you raise a really good question about the utility of the spirometer. People who are concerned about the race correction argue for longitudinal studies, that is, setting a baseline for an individual and following that individual's lung capacity over time. That's a very useful diagnostic tool. Once you start looking at populations, you're set on a path of comparative frameworks between populations. First of all, you're assuming that those populations can be delineated with assurance that any person you think might be black self-identifies as black. It's a dicey path to be going down. So these what are called cross-sectional studies that set a norm and then are used, you know, for decades. I mean, we're still using norms developed, you know, 20 to 25 years ago. And we know lung capacity actually changes over time. that's where you have a problem, is when you're using standards from populations and assuming they're fixed, that they don't change over time. Mm-hmm. So whereas if you tested my lung capacity as an individual before I went to work in an asbestos factory and then followed it, you know, every 6 months working in an asbestos factory, and you would see it decline, my lung capacity decline, that's a useful use of the spirometer. This stuff is very technically complicated, and I think that's one reason why it's been overlooked, actually.
Right, right. And easy to actually, you know, to target in a certain sense in terms of being able to carry out this racialization of medicine. Let me quickly remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lundy Brown. Lundy's a professor of Africana Studies and Medical Science at Brown University. She's also the author of a killer new book called Breathing Race into the Machine, and it's The Surprising Career of the Spirometer from Plantation to Genetics. Now, Lundy, one of the things that I was thinking about, too, as I read your book and thought about it this morning when I jumped up out of bed because of the rain, you know, in L.A.
I'm happy to have the rain, right?
Yeah, I'm happy for weather living in L.A., okay? Yeah. Just weather, that's it. But, you know, you talk about this thing of, I thought it was very interesting, you talk about the racialization was not inevitable. And you start to dig into, well, how did it develop? And you state that the idea of racial differences in lung capacity can't be dismissed as the work of scientists with explicitly racist intent, although there are scientists who had explicitly racist intent involved in this, or as the product of pseudo-junk or bad science. And again, there is pseudo-junk and bad science out there. Right. But that this actually developed out of something different.
Yeah, so I do make that point quite explicitly. I interviewed a lot of physicians and operators of the machine in the course of this project. So I did both historical, archival work, and then a lot of interviews with contemporary users. Many people don't even realize that they're race correcting. So they ask for race along with age and gender and don't realize that there's a correction factor built in the machine. And, in fact, I had discussions with people where they said, no, we don't race correct. And then it turns out that, in fact, if you looked at the specification sheets, there were correction factors. So I think it would be ridiculous to call every user of this machine as having ill intent. I mean, in a way, it demonstrates how all of us are complicit in racist practices in societies, even if we don't know it. But nonetheless, this is taught in medical school, that blacks and whites have different lung capacity. It is in textbooks. It's a general view that, for reasons that I'm still puzzled by, we're only rarely contested. And so I mention in the book that the first two people to contest this were W.E.B. Du Bois and Kelly Miller in the late 19th century, when a truly racist book by Frederick Hoffman, Race, Traits, and Tendencies of the American Negro, was published. And he drew on lung capacity measurements to make an argument that blacks were unfit for freedom. So it was marshaled in important societal debates around emancipation. They knew this was a problem. They addressed it in great depth, actually. And then it just disappeared. The idea didn't disappear, but there was no contestation, actually, until mid-1980s, at least as I can find, in terms of any contestation that got the public eye, until the mid-1980s in apartheid South Africa by occupational health physicians working with black trade unions. And Johnny Myers is particularly important in this regard, and he wrote a paper saying basically one standard for all. And so what's interesting to me is the contestation happens in certain historical moments, but in other moments, you just don't see it. It has real consequences, as I point out in the book. So in the case of the asbestos litigation, if the company had been successful in its motion to the judge, black asbestos workers would have had to show lower lung capacity than white asbestos workers. So in other words, they would have had a harder time getting compensated, they would have had to have more lung damage. So, you know, it has really very profound consequences. I've talked to clinicians, and clinicians tend to use the spirometric measurements as part of the whole clinical exam. It's not the determinant of health or non-health. Where there's less nuance used actually is in research. And there, researchers don't use a correction factor and then don't look at it in any more detail. So this has real consequences.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to get into those consequences a little bit right now and then right after this, too. First, I want to tell people that we're talking with Lundy Brown, and she's the author of Breathing Race Into the Machine. It's a really fascinating book, a really important book for people to pick up and read and understand, especially in the times we're living in today. Now, Lundy, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is just off of what you were just talking about, the consequences. You know, part of what you talk about in this I found really fascinating, too, is that you make the point that this doesn't happen sort of just off to the side or just sort of pops up and pops in somebody's head. But it happens, you put it as, it happens in dialogue with other things going on in society. And I wanted you to talk about that in relation to both slavery and to the growth of capitalism at that time.
So this is something that I didn't actually anticipate finding, but because I started with the U.S. context. So I quickly found that lung capacity measurements were used in a large anthropometric study conducted at the end of the Civil War, where I think actually the architect of the study, Benjamin Gould, recognized that he had this giant laboratory of black and white soldiers that he could do comparative studies of, and they measured everything you could possibly imagine, you know, from lung capacity to height to little fingers. I mean, it was just, it's a 600-page book. It's incredible. But as I began to research the history of the project in, you know, a fairly academic way, I realized that in Britain, when the instrument first was applied to large numbers of people in the mid-19th century, what they were measuring, they were organizing the measurements according to occupation, which was the crude measure of social class. So in Britain at that time, in industrializing Britain, the category that was used was occupation. And I go into the book sort of why and the context of that. But what was really fascinating to me is that, first of all, that knowledge about the spirometer, including how to build the instrument itself, but of the measurements, it got to the U.S. really quickly. It went across continental Europe really quickly. And when it came to the U.S., the category deployed were not occupation, but racial categories. The first person I can find, and there may have been others, but Samuel Cartwright, who's a well-known plantation physician and well-known partly because he made up these categories of drapetomania, running away from plantations, that he applied to slaves. I mean, to read it now, it's extremely offensive. But he, again, was highly respected. He was trained at University of Pennsylvania. He was trained in the North. But he built a spirometer, and then he studied lung capacity in slaves and whites, and then made these arguments about fitness for plantation work. So another theme throughout this that recurred that I didn't know in before starting the study, which actually took about a decade, I have to say. It's a little embarrassing, but it ended up a very, very, very complicated. But labor is a really common theme. But it became racialized in the U.S. very early, like almost as soon as the instrument got to the across the Atlantic, it became racialized.
Mm-hmm.
So the argument I make is that those two categories of class and race are in dialogue, that if you have large numbers, you have to order those numbers in some way. And the social categories that made sense in mid-19th century Britain were different from the social categories that made sense in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, when you talk about that, too, one of the things that actually comes out very strikingly, as things go along, and I just have this Jones about this, we also have to include, as a great facilitator of all this, one of the most prolific serial rapists and child rapists in the history of this country, Thomas Jefferson, who was really full scale behind all this in terms of racialization of medicine. But, you know, there's also this point that comes out that, in relation to what the necessities facing slavery at the time and then capitalism at the time, and then as capitalism in the U.S. and in Europe moved to imperialism, the idea that there had to be this sort of definition, this defining of people, the other people out there or in there in relation to the U.S. as somehow being less than. And it also, you know, went together with a sort of weird kind of symbiotic relationship where the buildup of the white culture as the norm and the culture to be revered as the highest that humanity can get to while everybody else is some other level of less than human.
Yeah, and that, I mean, what you're raising is that science, biomedicine, and colonialism co-emerged. And so the ideas that drove colonialism, imperialism, were intimately embedded in the ideas that drove science. And there's nice work trying to demonstrate that, how it actually worked. I didn't start out trying to show that, but that's the story that became clear as I did my research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very powerfully put in the book. You know, one thing I wanted to also get into, and we have just time for a couple more questions, but there is a point here that I wanted to ask you. When we're talking about the consequences of this, the repercussions of this, the impact of all this on humanity, you know, there is this point. I was thinking about how do you get things like Rwanda? How do you get things like, and I'm so glad that there was the kind of response to these, the spate of police murders and the justification of them in the most recent period. But you get this sense, you know, there's a whole effort that basically, again, whittles away at the humanity of people other than white people. I mean, it whittles away in this country, it whittles away at the humanity of black people, you know, in particular, which is, you know, there's been a whole genocidal impact of this. And when you look at this, when you look at what actually the repercussions of this, when that's accepted broadly in society, you're not even known about, not questioned a lot of times because it's not known about it, then who knows what people would do in terms of questioning. I would like to think people would say, what the hell? Stop that. But the basic point is there's real repercussions to this, and including the fact that there are these. It can lead to pogroms. It can lead to genocidal campaigns. It can lead to things like mass incarceration, like mass slaughter of young black men for raising their hands and saying, don't shoot.
You know, exactly. And that's one reason why I tried to embed the science of this instrument in what was going in the historical moment. And each of these historical moments was very different, but the science of race and is connected in very fundamental ways with what else is going on in society. So, I mean, I make the point about inevitability quite consciously because it's an argument for the possibility of change. So if we start to see how these things work, you know, racial disparities and disease are lethal. It doesn't look like the lethality of police brutality, but nonetheless, it's a slow death, and we know that minorities carry, particularly African Americans, carry a burden in terms of health for social reasons. And so, you know, the real argument of my book is that we should be looking at the social causes. Segregation, for example, that's been known for many years to have a major impact on health. So researchers, physicians, anyone interested in this whole, concerned about racial disparities, need to pay careful attention to how we explain difference. Because if we are explaining differences between groups, not on the basis of power and privilege, but on the basis of genetics, we are pathologizing groups. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this has been quite a contentious issue around the first race-based drug, Bidil. There needs to be more dialogue about it. And I actually tried to avoid accusatory tones as a way to engage more people in dialogue about the ways we think about other people. There's clear dehumanization, explicit dehumanization in some of the 19th century work. You don't see it as clearly in the contemporary moment. It's much harder for us to see this work in the contemporary moment,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in a healing practice like medicine.
Mm-hmm. Although I'll tell you, I'll never be able to go get my lungs tested, my breathing tested, without this coming up in my mind right away. Okay.
That happens to a lot of people. They ask, what's the correction factor?
Right. Did you push that button that says race?
Right.
You know, this is one thing I'm going to read, and then we'll have to go. But I want you to make a quick comment on this. But I was very moved by this at the end of the book. You say racialized science produces racialized results. To ascribe racial disparities in lung function and in disease more broadly to genetic differences, to ascribe pathology to entire groups of people. And then you go on a little bit later and you say, it's time to forge a new path, one that takes our common humanity as a starting point. And I couldn't agree with you more. It's really, really very important that people understand that.
Well, I think we need to be thinking more in terms of racism than race when we talk about health. Mm-hmm. How does racism produce poor health? And that would take us down another path. And there's many really great people trying to do this work. It just doesn't get as much funding as the genetic research does.
Mm-hmm. Lundy Brown, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed talking with you, too. Take care now.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Lundy Brown, a professor of Africana Studies and Medical Science at Brown University, and we've been talking about her book, Breathing Race into the Machine, The Surprising Career of the Spirometer from Plantation to Genetics. We're going to take a longer-than-usual music break because the song is just that damn good. But when we come back, we will be talking with Iranian-American filmmaker, director Anna Lily Amirpour about her feature film debut, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. So stay tuned.
Can you see us running all through your streets? Dark clouds rolling, waters at our feet. Lives are empty, we're on our own. No one to help us, can you throw us a bone? But you don't see us, you don't even try. Our children are hungry, you don't hear them cry. Cause we are the invisible ones, the invisible ones you'd let die. Been here all along, yeah, right next door. Just working class with a working poor. And if you had a nickel and I had a dime, if you were in need, I'd give you mine. But then you'd pass me right on the street. You'd look away down at your feet. Cause we are the invisible ones, the invisible ones you can't see. The invisible ones. On your front gate, you hung a sign, bring us the poor and the tired inside. Bring the huddled masses, we believed in you. Wasn't nothing we wouldn't do. But you don't see us, you don't really try. We're the invisible ones, and we're left outside. We are the invisible.
Invisible one. Oh, we are the invisible one. here to stay.
All right, welcome back. That was Charlie Musselwhite with the song Invisible Ones. Now, what we're going to be listening to is an interview I did with Anna Lilia Mirpour about a film that debuted at the Sundance Film Festival last January 2014. And the film is a really amazing film. And Anna Lilia Mirpour is an Iranian-American film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor. And she's most known for this feature film debut, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. And she describes it as an Iranian vampire spaghetti western. And as I said, it made its debut at the Sundance Film Festival. And right now you can find it on Netflix and other discerning theaters throughout the world. Really try to find this film and see it. You're not going to regret it. So without any further ado, let's listen to the interview I recently conducted with Anna Lilia Mirpour. At this last Sundance, I had a chance to see a whole lot of movies, a lot that were just really intriguing, that were very different than things that I might normally see. One of the films that I noticed at Sundance was a film called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. A lot of people were talking about it, and I recently watched A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night and then kept the lights on all night long, okay? There was one part. And I was really, I saw it with a friend, and we talked about it for about an hour afterwards. Even more importantly, I had the chance to talk with the director of the film. And the director of the film A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is Anna Lilia Mirpour. And I have been looking forward to talking to Lily for quite some time because this is a film that I think only she is going to be able to explain and answer all of my questions in some kind of rational way. Lily, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have to tell you, I just sat there. I was like, whoa, this is
cool. Yeah. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall for the hour-long conversation you had afterwards.
Yeah, well, you'll probably get some of it today. So, anyway, I want you to give people a brief description of the film.
Well, it's a black and white Iranian vampire western, and it's basically a dark fairy tale about this Iranian vampire, the girl, and she's living in this kind of lawless, middle-of-nowhere ghost town called Bad City, filled with all different sorts of kind of unsavory people. There's a lot of prostitutes and drug addicts and kind of people that were dealt a bad hand. And she's trying to figure out who to eat for dinner. And then she kind of, her whole thing kind of falls askew because she falls for one of the people in the town.
But there's an element of this as well, I think. I mean, look, when I think about it, I keep thinking about, okay, all the things you said, including it being a romantic fantasy, but it's got a vampire as sort of an avenger and protector of women, and she's patrolling the night in a black chador and a striped T-shirt. And I kept thinking, this puts so much together. It just spins your head around when you see this. And I was really impressed with that, you know, because it's sort of, I'd ask you this, because even that striped T-shirt, you know, you have the chador and that, all the image that conjures up, and you have the idea of knowing that this is a vampire. And then you also see the striped T-shirt, which kind of brings into, to my mind, brings into everything from circus clowns to mimes to whatever. What the hell was the inspiration for the film?
There's many, many inspirations. I mean, it's hard to talk about that because if you could talk about the inspiration for the soundtrack or the inspiration for the way the characters look or the town or certain things, so many things. But you mentioned the striped shirt the vampire wears, and I was very into Godard's Breathless, the character's outfit in that. She's kind of got this gamine kind of waif-like look. And so that was one of the things that came, where that came from. There's a character inspired by James Dean. The pimp is inspired by Ninja from De Antwoord, the South African rap rave group. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that I think pollinate different ideas and characters and things. And so, but I've really first got the idea for the movie because I put a chador on, this black kind of piece of fabric, and I just felt like a bat. I felt like a superhero in some way, and I just wanted to ride a skateboard with it on and with the fabric sailing in the wind. So it started around this idea of this Iranian vampire, and it's also a really brilliant disguise because nobody expects anything from this girl. So in that way, I guess she's kind of like Clark Kent.
Yes, or Bruce Wayne. There you go.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Anna Lily Amirpour. Lily is the director of the film A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. You know, one thing in the film that really got me, too, though, is that, well, you have the title, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, and you keep looking at that, and what plays in people's mind automatically is, okay, this is dangerous. This is not something you want to do in a big city, in a small city. This is just sort of, you know, given the widespread misogyny and all the rest of this that goes on. And yet your film just turns that around in a way that's completely unexpected, because this woman who really is so, on one level, so unthreatening, but so strange looking that, you know, people are kind of like, whoa, what's this? But she actually becomes, instead of a victim, becomes the actual, this dealing out justice against injustice.
I personally didn't actually, it's interesting to hear you say that. I like hearing how people feel about a film, and I feel like every feeling is valid because a film is like a piece of music or something. It's there for you to connect with emotionally and whatever you have experienced as a person. That's what you end up taking away from a film, really, is stuff that you are. So, but the idea of justice and injustice is a tricky thing, and because you never... It's hard to pass judgment because you need information to be complete, and it's never complete because everybody has lots of experiences and things that are part of their story. So it's tricky to decide who's good or bad, and I don't actually know that it's really completely possible to do it efficiently. And I think for me, the film is more about peeling back layers, because I think anything from this girl's chador and what kind of person that makes you assume she is, or just the idea of a girl walking home alone at night and that might make you think she's, you know, at risk, or a pimp or a prostitute or this drug addict, like all the things that you might assume to know about people at first glance is usually never the case. If you peel back the layers, people have very strange secret things inside them, and oftentimes those things contradict the outside thing that you first assumed. So I'm very, personally, myself, I'm very into peeling back the layers and questioning the system. So
that's interesting because, you know, I was thinking, even as you're saying this, it's true that there's this, I mean, for me, it was, you know, most of the people that I saw getting killed were, you know, people who were the really horrendous pimp, or the father that actually had, in a certain way, really fallen into complete human disrepair. And then there was this homeless person in the alleyway who got the blood sucked out of them. You know, and I was kind of like, wait a minute, that doesn't fit. What the hell's going on here?
I'm glad you brought him up. It's like, what did he do?
Yeah, right. What the hell? Yeah. Come on. I was just getting sense in this universe, man. And now you can do this. And it was also interesting that while there was a certain amount of tenderness shown to a little boy, your character also scared the hell out of the kid, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly the thing. And I just think it's that's the thing. I think all these, just assuming it's feminist or this or that, or that she's an Avenger, I think it lets you off the hook, because there's no such thing as true justice, and there's no such thing as an adventure. These are inventions that we have. I mean, in real life, you have to weigh and process every single thing and every single interaction if you want to kind of really see what's going on. And so I think there's always one more piece of information. Like, no matter what information you've gathered, there could be another piece that throws the whole thing askew. So, I don't know. I mean, she's killing people, you know? It's just kind of like also the thing with, like, I don't know, Tony Soprano, for example. You have this character, and everybody loves him, you know? And he's doing awful, awful things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, all you have to do is see him adoring the ducks in his swimming pool, and you're like, oh, he's an adorable gangster, you know? I mean, it's like, I just think that there's always more information it's never, I mean, even you, even I don't know myself fully. So it's it's almost absurd to assume that we can know people fully. You know?
But it's interesting, too, because you also, in the course of the film, there's so many things that get just juxtaposed. I mean, there's the raver in the Reagan mask. Then there's the trans woman who is doing this dance that was just so gripping and moving to watch that. You know, and you're looking at all these various people and the older prostitute, you know, the fact when she goes out and she thinks she's getting the pimp's car and, you know, scratch and scraping it. There's all these little things that just are incredible in terms of how it just moves you from one spot to the next, from one feeling, from one assessment to the next, and sometimes contradictory, sometimes they, you know, reinforce one another. But it's also, there seems to be some kind of this, I don't know, this play on sort of like, there's all these disenfranchised people and alienated people, and some prey on them and others don't, you know, and it's, I was just, that's why I felt the thing about the, you know, maybe not justice is so good, but, or avenging or something, but it really does come across as the idea that there's a unity between the young woman, the vampire, and all these people who are just alienated and mistreated and whatever in society.
I think, yeah, I mean, I was definitely, there's definitely a lot about loneliness at the core of the film, and for me and for the lead character, but for all the characters. I mean, a vampire is kind of like the ultimate lonely character because they have to grapple with so much time and they really only have themselves. And that's why actually her music was such a big thing too, because that's the constant friend through the centuries that you can always count on. But all the characters in the film, you know, are dealing with some kind of loneliness and some kind of this isolation. And I mean, I think it's really fascinating and inspiring to me how people deal with despair and continue to forge on in spite of it and just looking for magic, you know, like this thing to happen, this undeniable thing, which rarely happens, but sometimes it does. And yeah.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Anna Lily Amirpour. Lily is the director of the film A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. You know, one thing that's kind of interesting too, because there was a humanization and really a tenderness that was brought out about both with the woman, the vampire, both with her, but also with a guy, Arash, and the whole, you know, the idea that they were both sort of, you got a sense of this young woman being, I don't know, again, this could be me, but what the hell, I'll just say it because it is. You know, the sense of that, the tenderness and even as a vampire, a certain amount of, you know, walking through the world with a certain amount of jaded innocence, but innocence to a certain extent. And then the guy is actually someone who's really trying to just do whatever, you know, and yes, it's rebellious in the context of the set that he's in and the scene that he's in, but there's something that draws these two people together. And two of the scenes that really got me were, because they showed some of this, I think, the one, they both involved the skateboard, and the one was the vampire rolling down the street unsteadily, using the wall to balance and rolling towards the next victim. And the other was the vampire pushing the smiling, drugged out Arash to her home, which I thought was great.
Yeah. I have this joke that was like her saying that was, you know, like taking home takeaway dinner. Like, you know? I'll have that to go. And pushing her dinner home on the skateboard. But yeah, no, it was fun. I just had a thought, but it just jumped out of my head. those darn pesky thoughts. They just jump in and jump out. You got to grab them.
Yep. Either that or close your eyes and they can't get out. They always told me.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
I got it.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about this thing about innocence, if there is any innocence that you see in both these characters in a way that... And I do think, her room, while it captures that loneliness you talked about, there was also, when she brought him in, there was a certain amount of innocence and love that got expressed there that actually sort of stepped out of the whole world that you created.
Yeah, I mean, when they were in the room, that was really the moment of the film in a way for me, just because it's like the moment of the connection. And for me, it was more fun thinking about the physics of connection, and like that's why it's like just the idea that all the magic is in the space between two people, and how slowly can you close that space, and just how palpable it is. And so I felt, because when you're making a film and editing a film, you watch it over and over and over and over and over and over to the point where you hate looking at it. But there, that scene, I can never get sick of myself, and that's, you know, that doesn't happen that often. It's just there's some magic in it for me. I think it's interesting, the idea of like this tenderness and this affection, because at the same time, I feel like both sides are very natural. Like, I personally feel that violence and destruction is natural, and I also feel that the tenderness is natural, and I feel like it's both together that make us human, and how we deal with both. And because of, you know, the cat and sort of this idea that he wants to, that he takes this cat, and, you know, it's an interesting thing that we have pets just as a crazy phenomenon, that we just saw these creatures and decided that we would take them and care for them and love them and give them names and sometimes put shirts on. Like, what is that impulse, you know, to take a little creature and just make it your thing that you love? And it's different from you enough to where you can suspend your disbelief and have this relationship with it, where you never really know each other, but somehow love each other. I feel like there's something about that with a vampire and a human relationship, because a vampire is not human. So when I was thinking about it and how he kind of takes the cat, I think he's almost like the cat to her in a way.
I was just glad she didn't eat the cat, okay? And I'm not a cat person. I just didn't want to see a cat get eaten. But
you're not a cat person, but no. But that cat in my film is an exceptional cat.
Yes, exactly.
A typical cat.
Exactly. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Anna Lily Amirpour. Lily is the director of the film A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. But the other thing, too, that, you know, this thing is, because what happened with them, and it's interesting, you said she's a vampire, she's not human, he's human. Yeah, but there is this thing that the two of them can only they're living in this world that I think even this, you know, the setting for the whole thing, and it's in black and white, and it's, you know, which is very, very cool. And but then the thing of, I mean, from the very beginning where you're sort of, you come across and then you pass this ditch, and I'm sitting there, I start, wait a minute, is that full of bodies? It's like, okay, but you're getting all of that, but you're getting this whole thing. Everything that happens there is just so desolate and hard and in a sense dry and just like not a place, not a nice place that people could thrive in. And you're looking at these two beings could actually, they can only survive really the whole despair and loneliness of all this through the love that they've managed to find with each other.
That's really sweet. I think you're a very optimistic and romantic person. I think you're outing yourself right now. You're reviewing your inner workings.
Oh, well. What can I say?
Yeah.
You thought...
believe in love.
You were... Yeah. Well, yeah, I do. And tell me that. Now, the ear-piercing scene. That was not... What could that be other than what I just said? You know, she could have just said, all right, you know, I'm playing with dinner. She could have been like playing with the mouse, you know, just getting ready to eat. But it was just such a tender, moving moment. You know, the whole idea.
I think there's something about that scene. I love that scene as well at the power plant. I knew I wanted him to do that, for her to, you know, have him do that, pierce her ears. I think there's something about it where... she's kind of asking him to make her right. I think she's aware of the fact that she's different, and you know, it's kind of this idea like, make me right, make me, fix me, you know, which I think romantic love sometimes, either voluntarily or involuntarily, like, you do that with another person, but... Yeah. You know, I saw this, we were, when me and Sheila who plays the girl were talking about the character and creating the character. I was sending her a lot of videos of cobras and cats and animals like that and how they behave, because we were designing a creature, essentially, but who has a human side as well. But there was this one video of a leopard, I think it's a leopard, who kills this baboon, and then after the leopard has killed the baboon, discovers a baby baboon was on it was a mother and there was a baby. And it's a very, very small baby baboon, and it's really fragile and this helpless newborn. And the leopard just completely changes her behavior and picks up the baboon and starts mothering it and carries it up into a tree and, like, licks it and cares for it. And it's completely unexpected, and it's truly, I mean, you should Google it on YouTube, leopard kills baboon and saves baby. The baby ultimately dies because the baby needs its mother. It's a newborn. But watching this however many minutes of interaction between these completely mismatched creatures is, that to me, that's the magic. It's when you, I don't know, the floor is kind of taken out from beneath you, and what you expect is completely flipped upside down.
Exactly.
It's really magical.
Yeah, yeah. And you talk about me outing myself? Okay. You did it right there, okay?
Yeah, but the baby dies.
Yeah, but the leopard didn't kill the baby and eat it as a Hot Pocket.
Yeah. He didn't eat the baby, I don't think. I don't know, though. I didn't see the video past that point.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk with Sheila, but I really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, me too.
Yeah,
my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure, definitely. And let me know when you're doing something else in the future. I'd really like to see what you do.
Absolutely.
I'm strangely drawn to your work right now. Okay.
I like that. I'm strangely excited by that.
Okay, good. All right. I'll just don't come around the neighborhood wearing a chador and a striped T-shirt. All right. That's the only thing I beg you.
Okay. I hope that's going to be a thing next year at Halloween.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Louie. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, take care.
Okay, take care now. Bye.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Anna Lilia Mirpour. Lily is an Iranian-American film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor, and she's most known for her feature film debut, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which is what we have just been talking with her about. And this film is a self-described Iranian vampire spaghetti western that made its debut at the Sundance Film Festival in 2014, and which you can find in places like Netflix and other discerning purveyors of good movies. All right, so check this out. Really try to catch this film. You won't regret it. All right, think about all the things we've been talking about over the last couple of months, and then concentrate it up again in our conversation at the beginning of this show with Professor Lundy Brown about her book, Breathing Race Into the Machine, The Surprising Career of the Spirometer from Plantation to Genetics, and the whole way that black people have been completely dehumanized and continue to be dehumanized by this horrible system. Thinking about all that, and then thinking about what's been brought out, what's been exposed with the Senate report on torture. And believe me, that Senate report is fundamentally a cover-up. But boy, what you get into, even given that it's a cover-up, what's revealed there really should make you just puke with disgust and to really question the legitimacy of a system like this, the legitimacy of a system that goes all over the world and just does what they've revealed in that report, in that Senate report. And when I'm thinking about that, I thought, okay, what could we talk about here? I'd like to actually leave you with a thought that would kind of speak to this in a way that would challenge people, all right? And so check this out. This is from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his book, Basics, from the talks and writing of Bob Avakian. If you can conceive of a world without America, without everything America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything less? And then just one other thing from Bob Avakian to think about is they keep telling us that all of the criminal things that they've done, all the torture that they've unleashed on the people of the world, as they keep telling us that, well, it was only to keep America safe. Think of this, internationalism, the whole world comes first. That's a principle to live by, all right? So keep that in mind as we're going through the world today. And let me remind you again, to keep up on all of this and to get a deeper understanding of the world and what's going on in the world today and how to change it, make sure you visit revcom.us regularly, okay? That's revcom.us. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Professor Lundy Brown and Anna Lily Amirpour. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, if you want to follow me, you can do so on Facebook and Twitter. And just get out there and spread the word about this show and about what we need to be doing in the world today, okay? Don't keep quiet. And in relation to that, we're going to go out now with a piece from Funkadelic's album, America Eats Its Young. And this is Wake Up, all right? Listen to the call, sisters and brothers.